this afternoon, what I'm going to do is just give you a general overview about the breeding effort that's part of the Soybean Innovation Lab. I've got a number of people here listed that have contributed to the work that I'm going to be talking about. I'm not going to go through everybody's names right now, but I will later on. I've got another slide that describes everybody's roles. I do need to mention Randy Nelson, who's a USDA ARS scientist at the University of Illinois, and he's really been the leader of the breeding effort in the Soybean Innovation Lab. And I also need to mention Peter Goldsmith, who's also sitting here, and he's the overall PI of the Soybean Innovation Lab. He's an ag economist at the University of Illinois. So what I'm going to do this afternoon is first I'll talk about why soybeans in Africa. Why are we interested in promoting soybeans in Africa, and why did USAID fund work for soybeans in Africa? I'll give you some background information on the Soybean Innovation Lab. I'll give you an overview of our soybean breeding effort, what we're doing in Africa, and then I'll talk a little bit about a Pan-Africa variety testing program that we're starting with the Syngenta Foundation. So why soybeans in Africa? This is actually something that I think Doreen gave a pretty good overview of already, but I'll just basically repeat what she said. So we all know that Africa is nutritionally insecure, and diets in Africa are often insufficient for protein. And we know that soybeans is a great protein crop. If you look at various crops, soybean can produce the most protein on a per hectare basis of basically any crop. And if we could grow soybeans and we could incorporate soybeans into diets as well as feed the soybeans to animals, we could improve the protein in people's diets. Another thing that soybean has going for it is that it is a legume, and I don't need to talk about how legumes can fix nitrogen and can improve soil nutrition. So again, there's a lot of things that are really going for soybeans, and there are a lot of reasons why soybeans could be better utilized in Africa. So I'm going to only talk about the breeding effort that's part of the Soybean Innovation Lab, but I need to mention that there's a lot of other things going on part of the Soybean Innovation Lab. So we have plant breeder education. There's a master's program that's part of the Soybean Innovation Lab at the University of Ghana. There's work on grain and seed quality, on seed production, utilization for human nutrition as well as livestock. There's also work on economic, environmental, and gender impacts of soybean production. So there's a lot of different activities going on, and the plant breeding effort is just one of these activities. So for us, what we're really focused on, as well as the agronomic work that's part of the Innovation Lab, is really focused on is increasing yields. And we all know that growers are only going to embrace soybeans as a crop that they're going to grow when it's profitable. And in order to improve that profitability, we need better adapted cultivars for farmers to grow. We also need improved agronomic practices. I'm not going to talk about the agronomic research that's part of SIL, but in Ghana, there's a smart farm, which is testing various agronomic practices for soybeans in Africa, and they're working to improve these agronomic practices. So we've got some of this agronomic work going on, as well as finally extension. SIL doesn't really have an extension component, so we're mostly focused on the research, where once we get that research done, we'll be working with other partners to do the extension. So we know that we really need to improve yields of soybeans in Africa. So what I'm showing in this diagram is the average yields for soybeans in Africa. You can see here around 1,000 kilograms per hectare. That's compared to the soybean yields in the U.S., which are these red squares or diamonds here. What you can see is that soybean average yields in Africa right now are comparable or similar to U.S. yields back in the 1930s. So clearly we have a lot of potential there where we hopefully can improve the yields and bring them up to closer to what we're seeing in the U.S. And in order to do that, obviously we need better varieties as well as better agronomic practices. So for the breeding and genetic improvement effort, our goal is really to enable the breeders in Africa to be more effective in developing varieties through scaling up their program. So we're working with soybean breeders in Africa, and we're working with them to get them to improve their programs. The idea is that we really don't want to bring our own breeding program there, bring our own breeders there, because that's not going to be sustainable. Once still goes away, eventually, we want to be sure that these programs can continue. And we're doing that by working with the local breeders. And the participants for the breeding effort include, as I mentioned already, Randy Nelson, myself, and then Andrew Skabu, who's a soybean breeder at the University of Missouri. In Africa, we're working with Nicholas Denwar, who's a soybean breeder in Ghana with a national program there, Abush Tepse, who's a soybean breeder in Ethiopia with a national program there, and then Godfrey Chigiza, who's an IITA soybean breeder, and he's currently located in Zambia. A lot of the breeding effort for soybeans in Africa over the last 30 years has been done in IITA, and IITA has been a very important partner for us. And they're the ones who have really distributed a lot of varieties throughout Africa. So what are we doing? So one of the things we're doing is we're working with the breeders in Africa to provide some training. So a couple of the breeders are going to this African Plant Breeding Academy to upgrade some of their skills. We sponsored a visit of the breeders to visit research programs in the U.S. last fall, and the picture on the top shows the three breeders in Illinois looking at actually a thresher. We're also visiting the breeding programs in Africa at least annually to provide mentoring and advice as to how they're organizing their programs. And we're also building collaborations between the breeders we're working with. One of the things that we saw is that the breeders viewed themselves as very isolated when we started the project. And by getting the breeders together and to get them to work together and collaborate and exchange germplasm, I think that's going to help all their programs. We just actually had a meeting in Ghana a few weeks ago where we brought all three breeders together and we looked at the breeding plots in northern Ghana. Another thing we're doing is providing access to germplasm. So, you know, one of the things is that we saw that their programs were very limited in what germplasm they had. So we, especially through the germplasm collection that Randy Nelson runs, we've been able to bring in a lot of diverse germplasm from the U.S., from Brazil, some rust-resistant germplasm, and they've been evaluating this germplasm both as potential drug releases as well as parents to be used in their programs. So one of the things we've been very interested in is understanding the diversity in the germplasm in Africa. And what we've done is some work looking at the IITA germplasm and comparing that germplasm to other germplasm pools. And this is a principal component analysis of these different germplasm pools using genetic markers that were that we obtained using GBS. And this work was done by Francois Belzile, who's a researcher at the University of Laval in Canada. And what you can see is that we have a Canadian pool I've just circled here with the teal circle. There is the Brazilian pool that's circled with the with green. And then we have the U.S. pool that covers basically the Canadian-Brazilian pool. And that makes sense. We know that a lot of the Canadian and Brazilian germplasm were derived from U.S. germplasm. And then we have the African or IITA germplasm on the bottom. This shows that that's actually some fairly diverse germplasm. And I think just recently there was some discussion about the origin of the African germplasm. And we believe that a lot of this came out of Asia as well as the U.S., and they've mixed some of those pools together. But anyway, what I think this analysis shows is that there is a lot of diversity when you compare the African germplasm to U.S. germplasm. So hopefully by introducing some of the high-yielding genes from the U.S. germplasm that have resulted through the last 50 years of breeding here, we can hopefully improve some of the yields of varieties in Africa. We don't have a lot of data through this program so far. We've just finished the third year. These are some results from some tests that were done in Ethiopia from our partner there. And what he's providing here are data from six different environments in Ethiopia in 2015. What I've done is I've highlighted the four Ethiopian checks, and then I've highlighted the three highest yielding genotypes in each one of the locations. If you look across locations, which is the column all the way on the right, you can see that actually their local checks were the ones that had the greatest yield. But what we can see is that some of the introduced germplasm from the U.S., which is the majority of the rest of the material, were some of the highest yielding genotypes in a lot of the tests, and they're actually very similar to the highest yielding germplasm across all the tests. So what it shows is that we can introduce some of this germplasm from the U.S., and it's actually very competitive with the local material, and hopefully will be cross-compatible with their material and help the breeding programs accelerate yield potential. One interesting thing is that a lot of the germplasm that has done very well in Ethiopia is actually from the Mid-South in the U.S. So they're maturity group 4 and 5 germplasm from the U.S. And where we are in Ethiopia is about 7 degrees north latitude. This material is actually adapted to about 35 degrees north latitude. So it really surprised us how well it did there. I think the reason it's doing fairly well is that not only is it day length that triggers flowering and maturity, but it's also temperature. And we're at a fairly high elevation here in where this material is being grown in Ethiopia, and I think that's what's delaying the flowering and maturity. We've also been providing equipment and resources to hire personnel. We've provided some threshers, vehicles, simple breeding equipment that wasn't available to the breeders before the project started. They've also been able to hire some additional personnel to expand their programs with the funding we're providing. So the final thing I'll talk about is the work we're doing for regional testing through the Syngenta Foundation. So the Syngenta Foundation is actually separate from Syngenta, the company. This is a charitable foundation that the company set up. And what they have is actually trialing programs for many different crops. And we connected with them, and they said that they were very interested in working with us on soybeans. So we worked together with the Syngenta Foundation, and we identified suppliers of seed, both companies as well as national programs throughout Africa, as well as some varieties from Brazil that have now gone into their trialing program. And this just shows some data from four locations in Kenya that was in one of their first trials that they grew. So we have yields in tons per hectare. So you can see across environments we had some varieties that yielded over 3 tons per hectare. We had to code the names of these varieties in order to maintain the confidentiality for the sources of the varieties. But what we see is that there's varieties from lots of different sources that are doing very well in Kenya. What the Syngenta Foundation is doing is going back to the providers of these varieties, and these providers are now using this to help them decide what regions now they should start marketing varieties. We're expanding this program, so now in 2017 we hope to grow trials now in 7 different countries. So we're hoping that, you know, through this Syngenta Foundation trialing, we're going to make more varieties available throughout Africa. So in conclusion, the support from the Soybean Innovation Lab, I think, is enabling breeders to become more productive to develop new high-yielding cultivars. And the Pan-Africa variety testing trials, I think, is providing some unbiased information on the performance of cultivars and helping these providers know where to market them. And with that, I hope there's time to answer any questions you might have. So IITA, most of their types are promiscuous. So yes. you know, most I mean, my understanding is that most of the germplasm that they're sending out to their cooperators are promiscuous. Like, for example, the Ghana program typically evaluates a lot of the IATA germplasm, and I think most of it has been promiscuous. So some of the breeders are inoculating, some are not. I mean, but on the other hand, I think it's good to have trials where you're not inoculating, so you find out which ones will do well when you're not inoculating. Yeah, Randy, correct me if I'm wrong. I think the ITA must define whether things are promiscuous or not. Do they define which lines are promiscuous? Yeah.
So
Ken Dashiell had been working on promiscuous varieties for, you know, for 20 years. Yeah. I mean, there's some question about whether promiscuous nodulating soybeans are the best if you have access to inoculant. Yes, so we haven't done anything for intercropping. I mean, right now the programs we're working with are so small and we don't want to increase the complexity of what they're doing. We just want them to have functioning programs where they can get good enough yield data to start making selections. So most of their trials are done at experiment stations where they have decent fertility. So again, we're trying not to make things complicated on them by saying you have to breed for all these different environments. Jim?
What range of maturities have you got on those genes in Ethiopia?
So mid-group fours, I think, were the earliest. Pritchard, is that a 6? 7. So 4 to 7. But they, I mean, they're not.
I don't know 4 to 7. I mean, we like.
So 7 would be grown in Georgia, southern Georgia. Group 4 would be southern Illinois.
I think soybeans is going to take 120 days or more. I think if dry beans, they're 100 days or less, you see. And one of the items is you have to get something that's early maturing. So I just wonder how that fits in.
Yeah, so I mean, like the group fours would be earlier maturing than the 6, but when we grow them all in Ethiopia, I didn't have the maturity dates. There may not be more than a week difference because of just the interaction, I guess, of the altitude and short days. I mean, they're not. If we would have tried to grow a 7 and a 4 at the same location here, it'd be like 40 days or 50 days difference between them.
Probably not going to work in this. Why would not develop a unique line
for one thing, we want to bring stuff from, let's say, the Midwest that has very high yield potential, cross it with the material that's adapted to the equator, and bring that adaptation with the higher yield potential and combine those two. So that's one strategy that we're certainly pursuing. But we have these unexpected results, like in Ethiopia. I would have never expected a group 4 to perform well there, and it does. So there's a lot of things that we just don't understand. And one of the things that we just don't deal with in the U.S. is the changes in elevation. So anyone who's been to the Midwest knows that it's relatively flat. There's just not much elevation difference. But you go to Ethiopia, and that station is at, 5,000, 6,000 feet above sea level? It's fairly cool. And these group fours that would be in the mid-south or midwest perform well. So, I mean, if we just assumed we had to bring things from the tropics in there, we would have made the wrong decision. We brought some of the Brazilian materials into Ethiopia, and they were far too late. Yeah, so you know, our efforts is really to help the breeders that are there make their programs more effective, and they're going to make the decisions on when they bring in participatory breeding. I believe some of them do have some of it going on already, but I think really our focus is to get the program so that they have good germplasm so that they can start doing these kinds of activities. That's right.
And there you would have what I would call the distribution issue. They don't have the same kind of company that would see distribution. So are you thinking ahead to that?
Yeah, so again, we're working with the national programs, and the national programs have their distribution systems that we're hoping that we're working with. We're not going to set up distribution systems ourselves. We want to work with people on the ground. One of the things is that USAID is working on trying to improve, like in northern Ghana, breeder seed production and things like that. So again, we're hoping to hand off the varieties, and USAID is spending, as far as I can tell, a lot of money to distribute, to increase seed and to get seed distributed. Would you agree with that, Pete? Pete's involved in that more than I am. Yeah, I mean, as all of you are pointing out, there's huge number of needs, and we have a finite budget. We're not going to solve everything. If we could do anything, we're going to solve one thing with the resources we have. And what we're focused on is solving the problem of having functioning and effective breeding programs. And we can't solve every other problem all the way through the supply chain.
But I think they identified what was interesting was you guys have identified some of the more fundamental formative steps that will enable all these other questions to fall in place. I don't think people realize how, you know, what the right word is, you know, economists can be pretty crass, but it was a really basic thing. Going on, it was not going on in breeding. And it was, you know, buttering
work substitute supply system. People assume, oh, I got product from IIPA or I got product from this product. And that's not really that appeal, but you know, it was problematic. So I think they've really gotten back to the basics, which is important.
One
last to follow up what you're saying, the seed system is never going to develop for soybean around 400 kilograms per hectare. It's going to have to take primary funds with something that yields enough to create incentive for the whole system.
Okay, thank you, Brian. Thank you, Dave, all for coming today.